Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. My name's Mark Thompson. I used to be a Lib Dem, and now I'm just the centrist dad. And I'm delighted to be joined by Labour activist Emma Burnell. Hi, Emma.
Hello. I think activist is probably overplaying it. Freelance journalist and Labour sympathiser.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, you are now a freelance journalist as well. I'm still thinking things were in the old days when you were very much a highly active Labour activist. But fair enough, I'll take the correction. We're not joined by Nick tonight because he's being interviewed by the police, apparently. So the first topic we wanted to talk about is...
I don't think we should just leave that hanging then.
I really, really wanted to leave that hanging. Okay, Nick is in some kind of police meeting in his capacity as a councillor. I preferred my phrasing, though. I'm sure he won't listen to this, so it won't matter.
You're terribly mean, and it's quite funny.
So, the first thing we were going to talk about, because you really can't get away from it, this actually, the last couple of days, it has died down a bit, but for weeks and weeks, it's all been about Harry and Meghan and the royal wedding. And the thing is, I'm slightly hesitant to discuss this because I'm an ardent Republican, and I know you are too, Emma. In fact, you might be even more militant than me on this subject.
Yeah, you're too wishy-washy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is one issue where maybe I am very much a Republican. So I'll maybe try and play devil's advocate a little bit here. But we don't really want to talk about the wedding and, you know, what she was wearing. I don't care about any of that stuff, and I know you don't either. I think, though, it is interesting because one thing I've thought for a very long time is I know that Republicanism is very much a minority point of view in this country. Polls regularly show that the monarchy has high levels of support. And I mean kind of, you know, 60, 70% plus, depending on how you phrase the question, sometimes it can go close to 80%. So we are very much in a minority. However, one thing that I do think that kind of gets ignored is the fact that there are other points of view out there. All the coverage of the monarchy on the media is almost uniformly sycophantic. And there is never really any serious discussion about whether we should have a monarchy and what is the monarchy for. I mean, okay, occasionally you'll get a documentary on Channel 4 once every 10 years or something. And I think there was some big debate on ITV in about 1997, but I seem to recall it was just basically people shouting at each other and they didn't really do any detailed analysis. But 98, 99% of the media coverage of the monarchy is just all about how wonderful they are and how dignified the Queen is and all of that stuff. And maybe the Queen is really dignified and maybe she has executed that office with, great skill over the years. I'm not necessarily denying that. But the question of whether we should have an hereditary head of state is just not really discussed. It's just a given. And one thing that frustrates me is that whenever this question bubbles up, it always seems to be around the time that something's going on. There'll be a wedding, there'll be a birth, there'll be someone's just died in the royal family. And it always feels to me, it does feel churlish to be discussing that stuff. But what that, at times like that, but what that means really, surely, is that at the times when those things aren't happening, and sometimes it feels like one of those things is always happening, but on the times when that isn't happening, surely that it is the media's duty to cover the 20 or 30 or maybe slightly more percent of people, you know, you're talking maybe nearly a third of the country who don't really agree with having an hereditary head of state. And that view is hardly ever reflected. Emma, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think I've got a point that there should be discussion of this? I'm not saying there should be every week. There should be a television program talking about whether we should have an elected head of state. But I can't remember the last time I saw one.
No, and I you're absolutely right. For my other podcast, sorry, Mark, I'm seeing other podcasts.
Yeah, I know. I knew you were. I just had this feeling.
We actually did The Crown this month, and that will be out over the weekend.
Give it a proper plug so people know what you're talking about.
So I do a podcast called The Zeitgeist Tapes, which talks about how politics and popular culture interact, and particularly how popular culture covers politics. And this month, because of the wedding, we decided to do The Crown, the Netflix series The Crown. And again, we were both Republicans, which is not guaranteed in Labour space, which is interesting. you know, Steve and I, Steve Fielding, who is my the person I do the podcast with, who's literally written the book on politics and popular culture, which is a very good book and people should read it. We're both Republicans. And he said to me, how is anyone who's Labour not a Republican? And I'm like, well, very few of them are. And looking at my, I mean, I went to Dublin for the weekend. I had a brilliant time learning all about the Easter uprisings and going out drinking in Temple Bar. And we went out on the Friday, had a very late one, very good one. So on the Saturday during the wedding, we were basically just having a hangover brunch. And it was on in the pub. And I was like, that's a nice dress. That's cute. That preacher seems to have been going for quite some time. Twitter's quite interesting. But everyone on my Twitter feed was all just totally monarchistic. And my Twitter feed is majority leftist, you know. And it was just like bizarre how many people who would call themselves from staunch or less staunch a socialist still are willing to subscribe to the idea of a hereditary monarchy. And I'm like, what? How do you even? How do you?
It sounds like you think those things are kind of fundamentally incompatible.
Exactly. Exactly. I just don't understand. Like, I can understand people going, it's not my top priority. It's not my top priority. But I fundamentally disagree with the hereditary principle of wealth and power, because I'm a socialist. That's sort of 101. So I find it very, very odd.
I mean, this is one of the things that I'm sure I have inherited from my parents in terms of mimetically, you know, meme-wise inherited, which is that the monarchy, it's not just the monarchy. I mean, I don't agree that we should, I don't think we should have an unelected head of state. I think that sends a really bad signal in terms of, you know, just privilege and the fact that, you know, you can just hand on your position to your child. I mean, that just seems very, it seems bizarre. If we didn't already have a monarchy, we would never invent it now. It's a very strange thing.
So anachronistic.
Hark back to the Dark Ages. Yeah, exactly. But I think the thing that's probably even more pernicious about the monarchy is that it is at the pinnacle and it props up the entire class structure and the entire aristocracy underneath it. It's like the aristocracy is kind of scaffolding upon which the monarchy sits. And so you have all these kind of social climbing aristocrats or wannabe aristocrats or people who want to marry into aristocratic families and the Duke of this and the Earl of that. And I mean, that, again, it's highly anachronistic, but it also just kind of perpetuates this idea that there are people who are born to greatness. There are people who are born that are better than us. I remember seeing a bizarre television report. I think it was on the BBC. It might have been ITV. I can't remember which channel it was now. And it was when Prince George had, I think he'd been going to preschool or something.
And which one's George?
They'd gone to the preschool. Sorry?
Which one's George?
Which one's George? He's the fourth in line. He's
the eldest. Okay. Sorry. I really don't keep
up. My, you really are out of touch. Yeah, good. Good for you to be that out of touch. You don't know who Prince George is. Well done. I actually envy that commitment to the cause, Emma. There was this piece about when he turned priest. He was about 18 months, 2 years old or something. And the reporter said something like, there were no tears from the young prince, despite the fact that there were very visible tears from others of a similar age. And it's like, I was speaking to my mum about this and she said, yeah, you know what they're saying, don't you? He's already better than us. And it's like, my mum was right. It's like, that's crazy. Like, highlighting the fact that he didn't cry and some of the children did. That's because he's royal. That's because he's better than them. And like, that kind of just silly, sycophantic fawning happens all the time with the coverage of the royals. And even when the royals do something wrong, it's spun and twisted by the media as if it seems like they've done something right. There was something that happened where the Queen was in some line where she was shaking hands with people, and she said something that was quite insulting to the person she was shaking hands with, and it was reported, because I think the microphones picked it up, and it was reported. But it was covered in such a way as it was embarrassing for the person she spoke to. Not that it was embarrassing for her, because she said it. And when Prince Charles said something about Nicholas Witchell, who was the royal correspondent for the BBC, I think he still is, Prince Charles said something about, oh, that awful man. What is that dreadful man doing? And again, that was seen as embarrassing for Nicholas Witchell because it put his position in jeopardy as the royal correspondent. It's like, hang on a minute, what about how rude it is for Prince Charles to say something like that about a man who spends his entire working life following him around, being fawning and sycophantic about it?
No, absolutely. And the thing is most people find it very, very hard to disconnect the individuals who are the members of the royal family, who are probably, some of them are quite nice, some of them are awful.
Some of them are definitely awful, and I know from having spoken to people who've met some of them, some of them, I'm sure, are.
I mean, my understanding is the younger royals are pretty cool, pretty good at doing their royal jobs and doing nice things for charity and don't ask for massive riders. And I hear Princess Anne is pretty cool. But the point is, some of them are assholes, some of them aren't. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The point is the symbolism and the actual institution is wrong. And I don't care whether you're the best person in the world or the worst person in the world. And neither, frankly, does the institution. You could be the worst person in the world and become the King or Queen of England because you're the next in line. And, you know, I remember about, when Diana died and they were having a bit of a crisis, there was a poll in a newspaper and it was like, do you want Prince Charles to take over or should it skip to Will? And I remember thinking, well, what a fucking stupid poll, because the whole point of the monarchy is we don't get a choice.
And anyone who says that they support the monarchy but then answered William
is it an idiot?
Just doesn't understand the thing that they supposedly support.
Yeah, we don't. There is no democracy in a constitutional monarchy. That's just literally not how it works.
Yeah. Okay, but let's get real here. I mean, as I said at the top, the polls demonstrate that a high proportion of people in this country support the monarchy. Why do you think that is? Because I'm sure quite a lot of the people who support the monarchy actually really deep down feel that, you know, people should be awarded positions on merit. I remember Nick Clegg made a speech where he actually used the words birth should never be destiny, because he was talking about, you know, how people who are born to poor backgrounds should be able to you know, rise up the social ranks and you know, get a good education and then ultimately get better jobs than perhaps their parents had. And I know what he meant, but I asked him, I interviewed him at Lib Dem conference in 2012, and I asked him, and he kind of obfuscated and didn't really answer. He said something like, I know what you're trying to get me to say, Mark, and then he kind of didn't answer the question. But I mean, I'm not picking on Nick Clegg, because this kind of dichotomy or paradox, whatever you want to call it, I think is in the minds of lots of people in this country, millions of people in this country. Why do you think that is? Why do you think so many people have such a blind spot for this? People who probably in other contexts would be quite happy to say that they're a meritocrat and that they want people from poor backgrounds to be able to rise up, and that just because your parents were wealthy shouldn't mean that you should be given privileges. I'm sure a lot of people deep down feel that. And yet when it comes to the monarchy, they just give it a pass. Why do you think that is?
My sense, and it is just, you know, my sense, is that people like non-political leaders. I think people are fed up with the way that we do politics. So the more fed up they get with politics being politics, the more they're willing to invest emotionally in this family who seem to rise above it. Now, I don't think they do rise above it. I think that you have to be very political to believe that they deserve their space. But they have done a bloody amazing PR job at making that not the case. So people see them as above politics. as different to politics. They genuinely think that us having a constitutional monarchy is not a political choice. I think that there has been a very, very good job of selling Queen Elizabeth in particular as rising above it. I suspect that the numbers will go down a little when Charles finally takes over, because he's not that popular and he's not seen as rising above it. He's very much known as an interferer in matters political. I don't think it will go down as far enough to threaten the monarchy or in any sense, but I think it will drop to maybe sort of slightly post 97 levels. Whether the apparatus that has done such a good job around the Queen will be able to do the same for Charles, we'll see. But he's been, the problem with Charles has been hanging around so long that I think his image is fixed in the public mind. But of course,
I think you're being a bit optimistic here, to be honest.
I'm not suggesting that Charles will be the last king in any way. What I suspect will happen is that Charles will reign for a short period, and either abdicates or he'll die, and then we'll get Wills. And people love Wills. They think of Wills the way they thought of Diane.
And I think William and Harry are both actually fine young men. And obviously, we don't have a choice in the matter. But I'm just saying, in terms of, like, you know, what that's going to do with public opinion. I mean, if even I can see that they, you know, that they are good, upstanding citizens, then in terms of them being the head of state, I'm sure the popularity will probably be similar to the Queen. But I don't necessarily think that the popularity of the monarchy is going to drop that much with Charles anyway, because you know what will happen? It'll be the novelty, first of all. First of all, there'll be a mass. Can you imagine the coverage when the Queen dies? I mean, you know, you saw what it was like when Diana.
Oh, yeah, there will be 6 months of you can't say anything because it's disrespectful to the dead Queen, who we all love, blah, blah, blah. And this is the problem, is that the moments that the constitutional monarchy could or could not be questioned or threatened are also the moments of the highest human emotion. So it's always when somebody dies that the constitutional monarchy is then passed on. That would be the natural moment to say, well, should it? But at the same time, what you get from people who support the monarchy is always, how dare you at this moment of our national mourning bring up this terrible topic? It's so disrespectful to our dead queen. And so you can't ever have a rational conversation.
Because it would be tawdry.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're obviously not going to resolve this problem. And actually, I think me and you probably both know, Emma, that we're not going to have any change to this within our lifetime. So the best we can do is try and shift public opinion a little bit in our direction. And then maybe in generations to come, finally, something will change. But
I went to the ballet the other night, and it was the opening night of a ballet. And I think it was Prince Edward. I don't know or care. But he's the patron of Sadler's Wells, I think. And he was there and they all played God Save the Queen. Everyone stood up and I sat down.
Good for you.
And I stayed sitting. And people were looking at me like I was a fucking leper. It was so bizarre.
I think you might.
Sadler's Wells is in Islington. Central.
The ballet, though, Emma. I mean, you know, you've got to pick your moments. You've got to pick your battles. Fair play to you. Fair play to you, though, for doing it. Sticking to your principles. I probably would have just stood up for a quiet life. Okay. Given that we're not going to change the situation with the monarchy, we should move on to our next topic. The Grenfell Tower inquiry opened this week. And for the first couple of weeks, they're taking statements from people and reflections upon how the tragedy, which happened a year ago, in which lots of people died in a fire that is now increasingly being seen as something that could have been prevented if the cladding had have been different and if perhaps different procedures had been in place. Obviously, it's heartbreaking to hear the stories of, you know, the family and friends that people have lost. Rather than focus too much on that, though, in terms of the wider politics of this and the, you know, has anything changed? Is anything going to change? It doesn't really feel to me like much has changed and is going to change. There was talk immediately afterwards, and I think some moves were made to do an audit of what's happening with other buildings and what's going on with the cladding. But there doesn't really seem to be much movement on doing very much. And of course, what that immediately told me was, well, okay, that's just fighting the last war. I'm not saying that doesn't need to be done. It obviously does. But what about all the other substandard things that have been done to buildings and other places over the years? It's almost just like, well, this specific thing happened, so let's have a look at what's happened with this. And, you know, like I say, that does need to happen. But there's a broader question here, isn't there? We weren't recording these podcasts when the Grenfell fire happened, so we've never really covered it. But I mean, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, do you at the time, like a year ago, it felt like this time it was different. There was such an outpouring of public anger at what had happened, and it felt like maybe this is a moment now. This could be a pivotal moment where the kind of callous disregard for people's lives when it comes to things like putting cladding on buildings will actually be seen as not acceptable. But it doesn't really feel like anything much has actually changed. Do you think I'm just being too cynical?
No, I don't think you're being cynical enough. It's not about putting cladding on buildings. It's about the mindset that leads to the cladding on the buildings. The view isn't pretty enough for the posh people. And that is still very much where we're at as a country. The view isn't pretty enough for the posh people, hide the poor. There are families who were burnt out of the Grenfell Tower who are still living in temporary accommodation, having had a promise on television by Theresa May, you will be rehoused in 5 weeks. They're not, and no one cares. No one cares, Mark. No one cares. And that breaks my heart. You know, there is nothing happening. That, you know, the anger that came out, that boiled up over Grenfell, it did feel like it was going to change things, and then it didn't change things. And that's going to happen again. It's like Hillsborough. It feels like Hillsborough. 20 years' time, the Grenfell families might get something that feels like justice. 20 years is too long to wait for justice. We have to stop asking working class people to wait 20 years for justice just because they're working class rather than posh.
Do you think that's what it is? Do you think if this had happened in, let's say, the Royal Albert Hall during some performance where lots of wealthy people were there and that had burned down and hundreds of people had died there, that there would be a very different reaction? By the establishment, I mean, not by the public, but by the establishment, by the government, by the civil service.
It would have been completely different, because they have sharp elbows and money and lawyers and barristers and connections, and they know how to make the system work for them. Those poor people in Grenfell, very few of them had connections, knew how to make the system work for them. And people who do know how to work the system have done the very, very best. And there are amazing people. I don't want to take away from anything that the people who are campaigning on this day in, day out are doing. But they're up against a tsunami of indifference, of structural indifference, of bureaucratic indifference, and of governmental indifference. And Theresa May does not give a flying shit. She just doesn't. She never has. You know, that whole bollocks speech that she made on her first day about how she was there for the left behind is just, she doesn't mean the people in Grenfell. She doesn't mean them at all. She never has. She means the people that occasionally get upset by being called gammon because they live in a market town. Now, there are definitely conversations to be had about why those people feel left behind and why the economy is failing them. I've just read James Bloodworth's excellent book, and I will be interviewing him for this podcast very shortly. But that does not mean that focusing on those people can be done at the expense of the people in Grenfell. And it just feels like we're playing off different sections of the working class against each other, while the 1% fritter away the rest of our lives. You know, if you look at the amount of empty property in London that is, you know, in the over £5 million category, society needs to be better than it currently is, and we are not treating people at the bottom end of society well at all. And it worries me so much that no one seems to care.
Well, I'm going to take a slightly different angle on this now. I don't necessarily disagree with what you said. I might not agree with the vehemence with which you express it, and I'm not sure I would describe Theresa May in the way that you have described her. Whatever the actions of the government or inactions may have been, I'm not sure I agree with your exact characterisation, but I'm just going to come at it from a slightly different angle, which is I follow quite a broad spectrum of people on Twitter, and some of the people I follow on Twitter are probably what I would describe as perhaps not very nice people. And I do it deliberately because I try and use Twitter to be able to kind of take the temperature of what's going on. I don't just follow people who agree with me. I follow people from all political walks of life and not, you know, plenty of people who are apolitical. And one thing that I did notice in the aftermath of Grenfell is there were a couple of examples of other fires that happened in other buildings in London. I think it was like a short block of flats, like a three-story block of flats. There was a fire and there was somewhere else, some council house. And what I noticed, and this was from more than one person, it was from several people who I follow on Twitter, tweeted links to stories about those fires with comments like, somebody wants a new house. Mm. In other words, they did it deliberately because they saw what happened in Grenfell and they wanted to be rehoused themselves. So, I mean, of course, that's just a few people on Twitter who I happen to follow. But doesn't that speak to a slightly broader issue that there are a lot of people in this country? It's not just going to be the three or four or five people I happen to notice on Twitter that day. There are substantial numbers of people who think that poor people kind of bring it on themselves.
Yes, there are substantial. They are currently winning, Mark. That's my point. Those nasty bastards are winning. They are winning the narrative. They are winning politics. They got Brexit. They're getting the worst kind of Brexit. They killed Joe. You know, these are the people who they've got Trump. We are currently being led by people enthralled to those people, people who are. I don't think Theresa May is those people, but I think she's so scared of them that she won't go against them. She won't stand up to them.
So what do you think? Are we just talking about a kind of fundamental aspect of human nature of, you know, jealousy or kind of the in-group, out-group mentality where those people aren't part of our group or they want to feel like they're social betters and therefore those people are just basically animals, are kind of proles versus the members of the outer party, inner party, all of that sort of dynamic. Because it kind of felt to me for quite a while like we were better than that, but it does feel like there's been some backsliding in the last few years back to a kind of attitudes that were more prevalent in earlier times. I slightly feel like I'm maybe out of time myself, like I came to kind of political sentience during a time that was more progressive, and now we've kind of gone backwards, and I'm not quite sure how to handle that, because I was brought up to have respect for other people and to kind of respect other people's motives and not judge other people on a superficial basis, and yet that just seems to happen all the time now.
We on the left or the centre, as you are, we thought we'd won and we failed to implement the win. We did not, we changed the laws and we changed some of the implementation of the laws, but we didn't change the culture. We didn't root it. We didn't make it depth. We didn't put it as part of, you know, we didn't say, and part of that was we were so scared of our win. We forgot to say the reason we won is because we're right. And the reason we're right is because we won. And you know what? it is not okay to think the way you think. It is not okay to be racist. It is not okay to be sexist. It's not okay to be misogynistic. It's not okay to treat poor people badly. We kind of went, oh, well, you know, we're all middle class now. As if just by saying it would make it true. And instead, we just created this whole group of people who feel like they have this massive grievance, sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly, usually a grievance against, I think, the wrong groups of people, but they have a grievance. And now what we're getting is this huge backlash against liberalism that I think is undeserved for liberalism, but liberalism did nothing to protect itself against.
I mean, I guess I find it very strange because I think about there's a scene in The Simpsons where Mer Quimby is under he's under attack. Something happens in Springfield, and then I think a bear comes down from the hills or something and rips up a car or something, and then kind of disappears back into the hills. And then people are on at Quimby, you know, why aren't you doing anything about the bears? And then everyone's really angry with him. And then he says, he makes a speech where he basically just says, well, it's not really anything to do with the bears. It's all the immigrants. And Mo, who is kind of an avatar in The Simpsons for like the, you know, the thought processes of the common man in quotes, says, immigrants, I knew it was them. Even when it was the bears, I knew it was them. And then they all start, they all pick up the pitchforks to, you know, go and get the immigrants. And I watched that scene whenever that was first broadcast, I don't know, 20 years ago. It's just like a kind of, you know, yeah, yeah, I'm glad we don't live in times like that anymore. And yet, kind of, that's like an extreme parody, but it's not a million miles away from what we've seen in political discourse, both in this country and America in the last few years. And it just...
No, absolutely. I think we got smug. We thought we won. We got smug. And we're being absolutely battered.
Okay, well, that's highly depressing. But probably to a large extent, we haven't really got an unfinally story to. We have, but it's about Ken Livingstone leaving the Labour Party, although it's not the first time he's left the Labour Party. But it does seem there's something somewhat final about this now. I mean, obviously, you're a member of the Labour Party. Have you met Ken Livingstone? I presume you have.
Yeah, several times.
Yeah. And I have a few times, actually. I was a guest on his radio show when he used to do an LBC show a few times. So I know what he's like close up. And he's always seemed a very kind of affable character to me. You know, he's made some missteps and he said some things he probably shouldn't have done. Why do you think he's leaving?
If you watched Sharmi Chakrabarti's interview on, I think it was Mar last weekend, it was quite clear that the Labour leadership was like, no, fuck this shit. You're going, you're gone. We need to make a point of getting rid of Ken. Sharmi Chakrabarti made it very clear that he wasn't welcome anymore. Ken jumped before he was pushed. In some ways, that was unhelpful of him. I think he sort of thinks he was being helpful to Jeremy by leaving, but actually, it would have been more helpful in terms of Jeremy's relationship with the Jewish community for Jeremy to be able to go, get the fuck out of my party.
Oh, that's a bit like that episode of The West Wing where President Bartlet tells Toby he can't resign, he has to fire him.
One of the key things that the Board of Deputies and other Jewish community groups were asking for was for Labour to get rid of Ken. He's just one member, but it's hugely symbolic and important and right that he's gone. That he's gone without any other censure is people are going back and forward on this. Honestly, I'm just glad he's gone. I think the Labour Party needs to move on. I think Labour in London particularly needs to move on. We should never have had him be our candidate last time around. It was a very, very bad decision. Not because of the anti-Semitism stuff, not just because of the anti-Semitism. I mean, the anti-Semitism stuff is appalling. He should not be a Labour member. I am very glad he's gone. There are other reasons not to have a candidate who has lost a previous election then run again. But I just feel like hopefully this will now give Labour a moment to say, look, we've one of the things that you've asked for has happened. These are the ways we're working on the other things you've asked for. Can we please try to fix this relationship?
Isn't he a bit of a scapegoat here for things that are happening in the party more broadly? I mean, it's not just Ken Livingstone that people think of when they think of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party.
No, but it was a massive symbol.
It almost feels like a kind of like a gesture rather than anything more substantive.
Oh, yeah, no, if nothing more substantive happens, then that would be a huge, huge problem. I am hoping lots of more substantive things will happen, but I'm hoping that this is a moment that can reopen a dialogue. I'm not asking for more than that. There is a lot more to be done, but Ken leaving, can I hope, reopen a dialogue? And also, I do... This is really hard to say in the right way because I'm so disgusted by the Ken Livingstone of the last 10 to maybe even 15 years. But Ken Livingstone, when he was leader of the GLC and when he was mayor of London, did some really good things. And it is so sad to see someone shit all over their legacy in such an appalling way that it's hard even to acknowledge the good things that he once did. And I hope that we can get some distance at some point whereby we can say, hey, you know what? Some of the things Ken did were good. We don't want Ken doing them again, but maybe other people could take them up.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make there because I think a lot of political figures end up like that, that they are tarnished and tainted either by, you know, later policy decisions. I mean, Tony Blair is an obvious example, you know. Walked on political water for the first 6 years of his premiership and then Iraq happened and that is all he's really remembered for now. Anytime he tries to say anything, you just get a chorus of people shouting Iraq at him and he can't get any cut through anymore. And with Ken, certainly for the foreseeable future, you know, he's going to be remembered for this.
Every time he says anything, everyone just shouts Hitler at him and usually he's shouting it back. That's the problem.
That's his own fault. The amount of times that
I am not in any way
defending it. It's just like it's almost comical. He's become a comedy trope, and that's always death for a politician. Although actually, someone like Ken might have been able to carry that if he just stopped going on about Hitler about 3 or 4 years ago. Maybe he might have been able to ride this stuff out, but he just won't. And he's stubbornly still sticking to. Well, I'm not even going to repeat the stuff that he said, but he's kind of reiterated it again in the last few days. Okay, we should wrap it up for today. So I'd just like to thank Emma for your time today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
And I'd also like to ask you, if you like this podcast and you're listening to it, so hopefully you do, then could you rate and review us on iTunes or whatever your podcast provider is, whatever rating systems they provide. I'd also like to thank Kevin McLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music, and this has been a Political Human production.
I'm Emma Burnell, a political journalist.
Hi, I'm Steve Fielding. I'm Professor of Political History at the University of Nottingham.
And together, we do a monthly podcast called The Zeitgeist Tapes.
During which we talk about a film, TV show, anything to do with culture and its political implications.
We hope you'll enjoy it. Please do look for us on iTunes as The Zeitgeist Tapes. And if you do enjoy it, don't forget to rate and review.